I know that you see these people on talk shows that come in to plug their books or their movies or whatever. Well, I'm not going to plug a movie or anything this morning. I didn't really come here with the idea of plugging this school, the School of Education, but Mark asked me that today if I would like to say a few words about the beginning of this session. And, of course, I didn't hesitate to respond in the affirmative, but I would like very much to say something about the new School of Education. I'd just like to say a few words about my own pilgrimage that God has led me through in this matter. I guess I've been interested in Christian education for most of my adult life. And I've taught Christian high school, the French Camp Academy, and I've had the privilege of being involved with a Christian day school. And this has been a great concern of mine for most of my life. It must have been about 1970, however, when I was driving back with my wife in Chicago, that I began to think. Somehow, the Lord just laid this on my heart. I'm nothing mystical, just somehow I began to think about this. A school of education, because actually, the kind of dichotomy we make between church education, school and education, family education, is kind of, I think, a wrong dichotomy today. But anyway, I began to think about a school of education in which we could really explore the partnership of the family and the school and the church, how those things interrelated with each other, and the proper role of each one, and to deal with the teaching learning process and that context and all of that kind of thing. And so I drove back to my home in Clarksville at that time, and I began to pray about this, and my wife prayed about this, and it wasn't too long after that that Reformed Seminary invited me to come down with the idea of starting a Department of Christian Education, and perhaps if things worked out to one day establish a School of Education. And so God has blessed us, and time went by, and it would look for a while like that there may be difficulties in getting that done, but there came a time when the board very enthusiastically endorsed this proposal. Then it looked like we wouldn't have a building to house this program in, which I thought very desirable in order to define the program better and to make it to be able to better promote the program. And so God laid upon the heart of a man who gave over $500,000 to build a building on our campus. We have today going up a 20,000 square foot, a little over that, I think, building. Part of it's a gymnasium for the whole seminary family, but the most of it is for the School of Education to house it. It has a place for 6 offices and places for secretaries. It has a faculty student lounge. It has 3 classrooms, which can be made into different size classrooms. It has a large media center and curriculum lab that is large in our frame of reference. It wouldn't be large for the University of Mississippi. We have our own lab. We're going to have our own lab school, a kindergarten and pre-kindergarten lab school with observation posts and so forth, that type of thing. And we have to try to develop a program wherein we're not only offering now the MCE degree and MDiv degree at Reformed Seminary, but now we're going to offer the Master of Education degree, a one-year degree, that in terms of number of hours, it'd be the same if you got it at Mississippi College, University of Mississippi, Mississippi State, or Mississippi Southern, or Delta State, or wherever. And we designed the program in such a way that we have the approval of the Southern Association of Colleges and Schools, which is the regional accrediting association for this area of the country, and that's the kind of accreditation that Mississippi State has, or Ole Miss has. And we've designed it in such a manner as also to be approved, to be in keeping with the State Department of Education certification standards. And so the idea being that you could come to this program and you could get a Master's of Education degree in school administration, and it would be fully certified. A AA certificate in Mississippi, probably it's called something else in other states. Or if you wanted to be elementary education, if you wanted to be an elementary teacher, you could do that. And we're offering secondary education with endorsement in Bible. Someday I hope we can do the whole secondary thing when transferring liberal arts work into that part of the program. But right now, we'll have secondary education with endorsement in Bible, elementary education, whatever you're teaching, school administration. Master's degree. Maybe one day down the line we'll offer a PhD degree in educational foundation, but that's where we are right now. And we're also concerned, and tell you this too, we're also concerned about financing the program beginning. We didn't know how our general constituency would respond to this program. But they have responded, many of them have, with great enthusiasm. And there was an individual who, knowing this was a pilot program, gave enough money to finance this additional program for the first 2 years of its existence. And so God's hand has obviously been in this program, and we covered your prayers, and if there are those of you who feel led to be a Christian teacher, we invite you to consider the program at Reformed Theological Seminary, or Christian Administrator. Thank you. I invite your attention to read once again that verse that I read to you a few moments ago. A majestic verse, glorious verse. For of him and through him and to him are all things, to whom be glory forever. Amen. In the last session, I talked to you about the fact that the real conflict was not between religion and fact, but between religion and religion, between the Christian religion and non-Christian religion. And that is true in our interpretation of everything that exists. It's true about everything. But it's certainly true in the area of education. We saw in the last session how the non-Christian has an interpretation of the student, which is not the same as a Christian's interpretation of the student, even though you're looking at the same phenomenon. That's not only true about the student, it's true about the curriculum. When you look at the curriculum, you've got a religious question here. You have to ask yourself the question, what is truth? There are some scholars in the field of education who believe sincerely that truth is relative. And thus they have one view of how to construct a curriculum. But there are those of us from a Christian perspective that believe the curriculum, that truth is absolute. And thus, and that all truth comes from God. And thus, that there's a unity of truth. And so that would make a difference in the way we would construct the curriculum. We talk about values what is the purpose of education? Why are you taking the education right now? That involves a religious question. It's rooted in your value system. I remember when I was coming along in school, 7th grade, 8th grade, our teachers used to tell us, well, if you finish the 8th grade, you'll make so many more thousands of dollars. If you don't, you ever heard that? If you finish the 12th grade, you'll make so many more thousands of dollars. If you finish 2 years of college, so much more. Senior high, you know, go through college, no, so many more thousands of dollars. Well, I've got 4 degrees this morning. I tell you, it hadn't quite worked out like that. But that should not be the fundamental purpose of a Christian getting an education. But that's what I was told of. That's not a scientific answer that's demonstrably proved to everybody and it cannot be disputed. That's a faith principle. That's a value judgment when a person tells you that's the purpose of education. Whenever a person does something and classroom that is not acceptable behavior, how do you call it? On what basis do you say that something is right or that something is wrong? If you're now in a situation in which you cannot declare your own faith, how do you say this is right and this is wrong? Well, a pragmatist may say it in terms of consequence. A Christian may give it in terms of the moral law revealed in the scripture. But it's not a conflict between religion and fact. It's a conflict between religion and religion as to how you determine what is right in that class. What is right conduct in a classroom? You've got to have some standard by which you say this is right or this is wrong. And there's not simply a community consensus about moral values. It really isn't that. You can't simply get a lowest common denominator core of moral values that everybody supports. So there's always conduct that's rooted in your very basic religious commitment, whatever that might be. Now, I would like to talk about several educational philosophies. And I'm going to deal with three very briefly, necessarily very briefly, in this time span. And the reason why I selected these three is because they have been very dominant in the field of education in this century. The first two have been dominant in public education and general education. And the third one has had more influence through neo-orthodox theology and church education. The first one that I'd like to talk about is the philosophy of pragmatism, pragmatic view of education. Now, this has been by far the most influential philosophy of education in the 20th century, so far as I can tell. That's an interpretive matter, but that would be my honest opinion. I think you'll find literature would pretty much agree upon that. Even those who would not be with one mind with me in terms of my analysis of it would nevertheless say this has been the most influential philosophy in general education in the 20th century. It has been so influential that the average lay person who is only a little acquainted with professional education, it's likely to identify professional education with this point of view. If you'd walk into a library, almost any place, and pull out a textbook in elementary principles of education or secondary principles or school administration or whatever, it is very likely to have been written from either a pragmatic point of view or an eclectic view with a very strong strain of pragmatism in it. Most of the professional literature, for many reasons, has been written by the pragmatists. As you know, the person whose name is primarily associated with this philosophy is John Dewey. Now, John Dewey did not originate pragmatism. You can go back to ancient Greek thought to find some of the seeds of this kind of thinking. And you can find more recent philosophers, such as Charles Sanders Peirce and William James, who contributed significantly to the development of this point of view. But it was John Dewey who brought all these strains together and applied it to the field of education and popularized it. And he became a worldwide figure in education through his teaching at Columbia University, and through the writing of a number of books. When John Dewey taught at Columbia University from 1905 to 1930, it became almost a mark of prestige of a school of education if they had a number of persons with their PhD degree from Columbia University under John Dewey. And so he became a worldwide acclaimed person. He was a first-rate man, a first-rate philosopher. Whether you agree with him or not, anyone familiar with his writings would have to say he was a very significant scholar, a very influential philosopher in our time, besides, beyond the field of education. And the influential people in this field since his time have been his disciples, people like Bode and Kilpatrick and Theodore Brummell and people of that type. They are the ones who have been most influential in the field of professional education. What then are some of the views of the pragmatists? First of all, the pragmatists believe that man is limited to his own experience, that he is kind of shut up in a world of his own experience of tasting and touching and feeling and smelling in some purposeful way, that reality for man is his own sensory experience. That is his reality, and there's nothing beyond that reality. In other words, a human being who is simply a more complex form of animal life, nevertheless is the center of everything, and that behaving organism, the only reality for this behaving organism is simply his sensory experience, his interaction with the world about him and what he smells, tastes, such as through his sensory experience, and that there is nothing beyond that experience. It is for this reason that it may not be for this reason, but very much in keeping with that idea is the fact that the pragmatist rejects the supernatural. He rejects God. There is no transempirical reality as far as Dewey is concerned. He therefore rejects God. If you were to read a book like A Common Faith, in which John Dewey sets forth his views about God, you can very quickly see that he rejects the supernatural. For him, that's a matter of intellectual laziness. He even rejects the agnostic position, saying, well, if you don't know, you don't know, but that's still a halfway measure. What you really ought to do is simply reject the supernatural so that you can bring all of your mind to bear upon the problems of the here and now within the experiential continuum in which a person lives. That's reality for him. And he believes also in the importance of the behaving organism interacting with other behaving organisms, because it's as a behaving organism, that is you, a person, interacts with other behaving organisms that are the counterpart of himself, that he learns what it means to think, that he learns selfhood, that he learns language, that he learns the communication, that he can really expand and enrich his own experience only as he interacts with his own counterpart in his experiential situation. And so, for this reason, the pragmatist puts a great deal of emphasis upon group process and group dynamics. Now, they're not the only ones that do that. So if you see somebody who emphasizes group process, that doesn't necessarily mean he's a pragmatist, but it's certainly characteristic of their thinking. It's more important to have people involved in group activity and doing things together than any possible content that they may learn. The context of learning is much more important than the content of learning as far as a pragmatist is concerned. He also believes that truth is relative. That truth is, what's true today may not be true tomorrow. What's true for me may not be true for you. What's true for me today may not be true for me tomorrow. That it's simply relative to a given unit of experience. That knowledge is always subject to the present experience. So that there are no now, what does this mean? If that is true, it means there's no absolute body of truth to teach. I mean, he would not be concerned that you master and learn a body of truth such as history or literature or the Bible or the catechism. A body of truth would not be the thing he's concerned about. What he is concerned about is how to cope with this changing world in which he lives. And his experience, in his experiential continuum, as the child's experiencing, as the individual experiencing, whatever age we may be, as we are involved in the experience of life, of tasting, touching, feeling our experience, we come into contact with problems. Sometimes that experience ceases to flow smoothly, and we come into contact with problems. And so what the pragmatist wants the individual to do is simply to become more proficient in the solving of problems. He wants you to have more practice in problem solving. And thus you are likely to find so much of coursework in public education, Dave, structured just this way. Problems of arithmetic, problems of science, problems of social science, problems of economics, problems of almost everything. The idea being, it's not so important that you learn answers to questions that are absolute answers, that are permanent in their value. The real question is that you learn the practice of solving that type of problem. You learn the art of solving that type of a problem. John Dewey believes the scientific, he emphasized very much the scientific method, and I think it's a valid method. But he believed it could be applied to everything, whatever there is, it could be applied to. I wouldn't agree with that. But there's a very significant difference in the way, say, a pragmatist would make use of the scientific method and a Christian would. The pragmatist makes use of the scientific method as a means of solving a problem. The answer of the scientific method has no real permanent value to him because truth is relative. In other words, if I had a problem, and if I were to apply the scientific method, that is to say, I see the problem, and I collect it, I define the problem, then I collect the data that may be necessary to solve the problem, then I form the hypothesis, you see, as I think about this, and then I test the hypothesis and see if it works, and finally it does work, it gets me out of the situation, it solves the problem, it helps me do whatever it is I want to do. Then that's fine. I solved that problem. Now, that information may be useful to me the next time I come into a similar problem, but not necessarily so. You always have to hang loose to that information. You can never put a circle around that and say, that's truth. It therefore ought to be learned as a body, a part of a body of truth. You're always looking at any knowledge that you have in a very tentative fashion. It doesn't make any difference what it is, scientific knowledge, whatever it may be. You always have to look at it in a very tentative way. The thing he's concerned about is getting proficiency and coping with this changing reality in which we live. Everything's in a state of flux. And to become socially efficient, to become functional, to become efficient and problem-solving, that would be the end of education as far as a pragmatist is concerned. A pragmatist would also believe that a thing is good or bad in terms of its consequence. If it brings a good consequence, then it's good. If it brings a bad consequence, then it's bad. And you've heard statements like this all of your life. Honesty is the best policy. Why is it good to be honest? Well, they wouldn't say necessarily always be honest, but honesty is usually the best policy. Why is it usually the best policy? Because if you're honest, you won't get put in a hoosegow. If you're honest, people will think well of you. If you return somebody's wallet, they might give you a reward. I mean, the good consequences that can come from being honest. So honesty is the best policy. Or, why not commit crime? Not because the Bible says thou shalt not steal or thou shalt not kill, but the reason why you ought not to commit crime is because crime doesn't pay. It's to your advantage not to commit crime. There's some very wealthy gangsters in Chicago that would probably dispute that claim to some degree, that crime doesn't pay. It's paid pretty well for them. When you're dealing with this type of a value judgment, though, honesty is the best policy, or crime doesn't pay, and you could extend that to apply to every circumstance of life from that point of view. You have a problem. The problem is, how do you determine what is a good consequence and what is a bad consequence? What is a good consequence to you may not be the same for me. If you came to me for counseling and you said to me, I'm making good grades in my college work, I'm doing pretty well, I'm making straight A's, but I'm uptight all the time, I don't sleep well at night time, and I'm just not enjoying life very much these days, but I am doing real well in school. So you came to me for counseling, I said, okay, what you ought to do is hang loose. I mean, forget about those books, put them away. Go out and play tennis, you know, have some social life, really enjoy yourself. So 2 weeks later, you're out to, just really having a ball, and you're having a real good social life, and you're about to flunk out of school. Now, it's a matter of, which one of those situations would be the best? Now, they both may be bad, but what's the good consequence in one person's thinking may not be in another person's thinking. So what you've got to do, you've either got to go to some absolute norm, like the scripture, to say it's right or wrong, it's good or bad consequence, or you've simply got to admit that a good consequence is that which I want, simply what I really want. It's my desire to have it this way. There is no intermediate position here. And a pragmatist really leaves undefined what a good consequence is. Things like the new morality have a real background philosophically in pragmatism, where you're told to do the thing that brings the best consequence to a group of people. And if you've ever read somebody's book, like Fletcher's book on situation ethics, subtitled New Morality, he gives illustrations like the black lady with her baby, with a group of people traveling along the Cumberland Gap, and they're being chased by a group of marauding Indians, and the baby is about ready to, is crying and is about to give away their position. So the mother kills her child with her own hands. And she is applauded for doing this because in killing the child with her own hands, she saves the group. The greatest good is the greatest number. Utilitarian, that's a pragmatic principle also, you see. How do you decide what is good and bad? You've either got to have some kind of an absolute moral norm, or you simply got to say, I do what I want to do. And the pragmatist leaves undefined what a good consequence really is. It could be something for one person, something else for another person. Well, the pragmatist winds up with a highly anti-intellectual position. That was not true of Dewey. But there's a lot of anti-intellectualism in professional education today, and it's primarily because of the degeneration of Dewey's thought and succeeding generations. And that's one reason why you'll find in your major, in an elementary education major in a school, it doesn't make a difference what state it's in, it's a state regulation that requires that you have 36 hours of elementary education. Now, that in itself is not necessarily bad, because you need to be qualified and prepared to be an elementary teacher. But in many institutions, those 36 hours are given to a proliferation of methods courses. Not just one or two real good method courses, but you've got methods of teaching arithmetic, methods of teaching reading, methods of teaching almost everything. You do not have one single course in the history of education. You do not have one single course in sociology of education. You do not have one single course in philosophy of education. Now, that may differ from one school to another, but this has been my observation, that you have very little of that type of information about you. Elementary education people are usually not required to take educational psychology, and of all people, they need educational psychology. Some of this type of anti-intellectualism is because of the degeneration of the disciples of Dewey and succeeding generations, believing that truth is relative. No body of truth to be known. become more proficient in problem solving, coping. Methodology becomes reigns supreme. And the truth, you see, takes a back seat to the methodology itself, because there is no truth. Only the method is important. Well, let's look for a few minutes at behaviorism. When we hear about behaviorism, we probably identify it with B.S. Skinner, but there are many other behaviorists that might also be mentioned, but we'll probably confine most of our remarks to B.S. Skinner. If you've never read his book, Beyond Freedom and Dignity, then I would highly recommend that you do this, which will give you a real insight into where the behaviorist is coming from today in the area of psychology. Skinner believed, as a behaviorist, that man was more or less a machine, machine-like person. That is to say, there's no spiritual dimension to man. He can do nothing that's blameworthy and nothing that's praiseworthy. That he is the product of his genetic endowment, which can be traced to the evolutionary history of the species, and cultural conditioning. In other words, he is really the product of two things: his genetic endowment, that is explained in terms of evolution, and his cultural conditioning, that he's completely explained just in those two terms. Yeah, I think about personal things that happen sometimes. It's so much contrary to that. This is by way of parenthesis. It's amazing to me how you can visit in a hospital room, and how you can get in a hospital room is about the blankest neutral thing that anybody's, you know, that's true of most hospital rooms that I've been into. They're just kind of neutral, aren't they? But you can visit somebody an hour after they've been in that neutral, blank hospital room, and one room will be, there'll be magazines all over the room, there'll be cigarette butts, there'll be just, you know, it will be in disarray, it'll look like, you know, a collision happened out there someplace. It really will look bad. But you can go into another person's hospital room after they've been there for a little while, and there'll be things hanging up, and it looks so livable and so nice, it even looks like a nice place to be in. Now, that's not environmental conditioning, you see. That's something that the person brought in there with them. Now, I know that they would have another explanation for that, but I'm trying to simply say they're there are ways like this that you can see every day, how things are depending upon what you bring to a thing rather than what's done to you. When I lived in Clarksville, the Mint was about a mile away from a fast food service. And it must have been just the place where they got through with their drink, or got through with their hamburger, or got through with whatever they were eating and drinking, because my yard was all the time filled with debris. And I had a sneaking suspicion that there was something more than just cultural conditioning that was happening, you know, right there in my yard just at that particular time. Anyway, getting back to what I was saying, Skinner looks at a human being as though he is simply the product of environmental conditioning and genetic endowment, that he has no mind. He has brain. He has, you know, brain cells and the nerve endings and things of this type. But everything he does is a physical thing. It can be physiologically explained in terms of cause and effect. And that you're totally culturally conditioned, totally environmentally conditioned. For example, he says, and this is a quote from Skinner, if you had a Mongolian nomad, and if you would let that Mongolian nomad at birth change places with an American astronaut, change places with them, so that they had different environmental conditioning, that the Mongolian nomad would become an astronaut, and that the astronaut would become a nomad for all practical purposes. In another place, he quotes Gilbert Sayles with approval, and he says, if you took third little Hottentots and let them change places with third little aristocratic Englishmen, that for all practical purposes, the Hottentots will become third little conservatives, and the English aristocrats will become third little Hottentots. That's kind of hard to believe, but that's exactly what he says. It's purely dependent upon environmental conditioning. It's because of that belief that they believe that you can form a technology of behavior so that you can actually program a person to be what you want him to be. The behaviorist says if you could take a child at birth, you could program him to be whatever you wanted to be. If you wanted him to be a banker, you could program him to be a banker. If you wanted to program him to be a minister or a barkeeper or whatever you wanted to do, you could program that child to be whatever you wanted him to be through the technology of human behavior simply using reinforcement procedures which are common to behavioristic thought. Now, that's kind of a frightening thing. It's hard to believe that that's taken seriously, but it is taken seriously in our time. B.F. Skinner in this century is second only to Sigmund Freud in his acceptance as a psychologist in the Western world. Second only to Freud. What you can do with an animal, you can do with a human being. I was saying the other day, the last class session, something about that, and I mentioned again here, what you can do with a pigeon, you can do with a human being. And what you can do with a human being, you can do with a human race. You can program that pigeon to play ping pong. You can program a human being to do whatever it is you want him to be. And just as you can program a human being, you can program the whole human race. And in Beyond Freedom and Dignity, Skinner says his ideal is to program the human race to a world utopian society. And he describes the kind of utopian society that he wants to see the world programmed to be. What about our conduct in a situation like this? What ought people to be? How would he view this? You say, here we've got him. It may be that a behavioristic scientist could tell us how to do something, but even if he admitted that he could tell us how to do something, how could he tell us what ought to be? The scientist may tell us how to have an abortion, but he can't tell us whether or not we ought to have one. Not so, says Skinner. That's not the case. He thinks a scientist above all people should be able to tell you not only how to do the thing, but whether or not you ought to do it. And this is what he does. He uses the idea of the survival of the species as his supreme value judgment, the survival of the species. Behavior is good if it contributes to the reinforcement of behavior that contributes to the survival of the species. A thing is bad if it reinforces behavior that does not contribute to the survival of the species. Good and bad, therefore, is thought of in terms of whether or not it contributes to the survival of the species. Now you say that raises certain questions. Indeed it does. The one question may be, who's going to do the programming? And Francis Schaeffer, whom I have great admiration for, in his little book, Back to Freedom and Dignity, criticizes the behaviorist at this point. He says, when you look at that behaviorist who is doing the programming, you find a little man with a white coat on who's a sinner just like the rest of us are, you know. How is he going to ever get to the place where he knows how to program the human race to a utopian society? But you see, Skinner anticipates that question because he goes on to say in his own writing, the behaviorist scientist who programs the human race does not stand outside the process. He does not stand outside the process to program people. Rather, he is a part of the process. As a matter of fact, he says, the programmer himself is conditioned by environment to program. In other words, as a part of the process, he has been programmed by his environment to program others. You're programmed to program. You're conditioned to condition others. You do not stand outside the process. Now, as unacceptable as that may be, nevertheless, that is his beginning assumption. And if you agree with his beginning assumption, then logically speaking, he really has you. So the place to disagree with the behaviorist is not down the road a place. The place to disagree with him is at the very beginning when he says that a human being is nothing more than the total of his genetic endowment plus his environmental condition. That's the place where you have to disagree with on a religious ground. In other words, I'm saying you are made in the likeness of God. He is saying you're a machine that's environmentally conditioned. That's the point where you have to disagree with behaviors, not down the road a place. What have been the effects of behaviorism on education? There could be devastating effects in the years to come. There could come a time when whole schools are designed so that the environment of the school will condition the child towards certain behavior thought desirable by the programmer, whomever it may be. But right now, we can see very significant influence on schooling. Behavior modification has become almost an accepted definition of learning in many quarters. The way a person learns is simply through the modification of his behavior. It doesn't matter whether you understand the thing or not. The thing that matters is whether or not the overt behavior is what you want it to be. If you want a person to do a certain thing, you simply find out what he needs to know to do that certain thing, and you program him to do it. If you're going to, a person wants to be a geologist, what you would do would be to find out what a geologist says, where he goes, what he does, what kind of pictures he draws. I'm oversimplifying it now to make the point. And then you develop a program whereby you would systematically program him to become a geologist. Understanding, commitment, appreciation, those things have no place in his definition of learning. It's simply a matter of modifying one's behavior as though you're an empty organism. Sometimes it's called that, the philosophy of the empty organism. And that has a lot of influence in educational circles in our time. It does even in Christian schools. And there are some schools today who use program learning as a central thrust of their educational program, never stopping to ask themselves the question as to what effect it may have upon their biblical view of the child, of the student. Our testing, so much of the testing, the standardized testing, has come from behavioristic background. The way we state objectives today, and we have been led by the behaviorists to state objectives almost purely in behavioral, attainable, measurable terms. And while that has a place in the statement of objectives, we cannot, as Christians, be limited to the statement of objectives in terms of measurable, behavioral terms. And there's some things that can't be measured, as we pointed out in the last session. I had a Christian friend not too long ago to say to me, whatever there is about a human life, you can measure it. The fruit of the Spirit, you can measure it and tell how far a person is along in the sanctification process. I said to him, you can't do that. I mean, because there's a dimension about the person out here you simply cannot measure, that the human instrument cannot do this. It's almost an arrogance on our part to say that it can. You can get indicators to be sure, but you can't measure that. And if your person goes down that road, he finds himself breaking up sanctification into measurable parts. I can remember one time having an elder call me. He understood I was going to preach on tithing the next day. And he was concerned about that, and he was a dear friend of mine. And he said, Norman, you can't preach on tithing anymore. Our people just aren't ready for that. I mean, they probably don't give over 2% of their income. You know, why don't you preach on giving 3% or 4%? Next year, you know, 5%, and you just kind of build them up like this. And I said to my friend, I can't do that, you know. There's a scriptural idea that I have to set before my people, knowing that we're fallible people and that everybody's not going to measure up to that, but nevertheless, the idea is what I have to put before them. You can't put little stops. You can't break your sanctification down. You can't say, this year I'm going to reduce my cursing 50%. You know, this year I'm going to stop stealing 25%. You know, you can't do that. This year I'm going to have 10% less adultery in my life. You say, you can't do it that way. But you're led to that kind of thinking by the behavioristic idea of objectives. And I wish I had more time to spend on that. But one of the most visible effects has been in the area of program learning, teaching machines. I expect most of you are familiar with teaching machines and program learning. Let me review with you again how Skinner would teach a pigeon to play ping pong. If you had a pigeon over here and a ping pong ball over here, then in this random behavior, the pigeon would make a step toward this ping pong ball. Now he reinforces that behavior that leads him in this direction. Now when he no longer reinforces him except while he's here. But then he makes another random step this way, and then he reinforces on that behavior. Finally, he edges him through the process of edging. He edges him over here to the ping pong ball. Now when he gets over here to the ping pong ball, now in his random movement, he nudges the ping pong ball. Now he reinforces only that behavior when he nudges the ping pong ball. Now all you got to do is put another pigeon on the other side and get the ping pong ball coming back this way, and you've got a ping pong, you see, match going back and forth. Now the way you do a pigeon is the same way you do a human being. You take the information that you want him to do, or to learn, and you break it up into very, very small bits, into a smaller piece than the man normally conceptualizes. And you break it up into such small parts, and say maybe you have 40 or 50 steps over here. And if the idea, if you start at step one, you go to step 50 to know and to do or to learn whatever it is the behaviors want you to do and to modify your behavior at that point. Now, you put all of this on the program, and you've got a little piece of information, and then you have a little blank there maybe to fill in. This is one type of thing. If there are different types of programs, you have a little blank to fill in. Now, it deals with such a small bit of information, and it gives you pretty much the answer just before you begin. I mean, within the paragraph itself, within two or three lines itself, that it would be almost impossible to get a wrong answer. I mean, it's designed so that you never get a wrong answer. The idea is positive reinforcement. So you fill in that little blank, and you get the, and then you turn the machine. If you got a, you know, you can have a $1,000 machine, you can have an oatmeal box, if it works on the same principle. There are a lot of people in educational business who made millions of dollars off of this that ought not to have, because they could have been made much simpler and much less expensive. And then you either turn the machine or push a button or turn the oatmeal box to the whatever you got down here to where you see the answer on the other side, or maybe just move your hand down and take a ruler or something and move your hand down to where you can see what the answer is. And you're supposed to do that. Now you see that your answer is right. You see, you write the answer in and you pull the thing down and you push the thing and you see the answer is right. And you say, you know, great, that's marvelous. I got the answer. That's supposed to motivate you. So that's reinforcement. So 2 + 2 = 4. I got that right. So you go on the next step and you look at the next step and you fill in the answer and then you push the machine and you find that your answer is right and it keeps reinforcing you. And that reinforcement carries you from step 1 through step 30 or 40 or 50 or 200, whatever it can be. The idea is to take a program specially made for you and take you from step 1 through whatever steps that they want to take you through. Now, I'm not saying that there's no use for that. I do believe in God's common grace, that there are insights by the behaviorists that can be made use of by the Christian. I believe that. But the problem is where people have taken something like that and made it the central means of their teaching procedure, so that the student never has an opportunity to analyze. He never has an opportunity to interpret. He never has an opportunity to compare and to contrast and make judgments. And that can have a very serious effect, I believe, upon the life of the individual. If God is the author of all truth, and if truth is a unity, at some place we need to put truth, not in its smallest piece, in its smallest, most fragmented way, but at some point we need to put the fact in its widest possible context. And that's something that the program learning can never do, you see. It cannot put the fact in its widest possible context. I believe that as a Christian, it's a part of my responsibility, as I exercise a cultural mandate, to be able to understand my environment. And I could never do that if I had only program learning as a means of understanding. It can be used, I think, helpfully in auxiliary means, but not as a central thrust of learning. Finally, I would like to talk to you about existentialism. Existentialism has been primarily influential in education through New Orthodox theology. When we think about existentialism, we think about Soren Kierkegaard, who was the father of modern existentialism. Although Kierkegaard professed to be a Christian, and 20th century existentialists are very frequently atheistic, and openly so, atheistic existentialists. Kierkegaard was a brilliant man. He was a nut, but he was a brilliant nut. And he was a man that lived in the 19th century in Denmark. He was living at a time when the Danish State Lutheran Church was a very dead church, what they call dead orthodoxy. I think that's more lively hypocrisy, as someone has said, rather than dead orthodoxy, but a dead orthodox church. He was living at a time when the Hegelian philosophy, which absolutized human reason, was in vogue. And you can see that he is reacting against the deadness in the church, and he is reacting against an overuse of reason by the prevailing philosophy of that day. And you can see that throughout all of his writings. He was a curious individual. He wrote a number of books. His main work was a P.S., a postscript. He wrote a little book about this big called Philosophical Fragments. And then he wrote the P.S. to it, which is about this big, called Concluding Unscientific Postscripts of the Philosophical Fragments. And that is something of the, you know, the unusual character of the individual. For Kierkegaard and for existentialists, he begins by renouncing systems. A system would be the furthest thing from his mind. Today, there's a lot of said about not having systems. There's a lot of people today who think that having something like a catechism or a confession of faith is simply a contemporary form of scholasticism and reject that as being Christian because they reject systems. They believe that systems are by and large unchristian. Kierkegaard felt that. He did not feel like that it was right to have a system. He said people that build systems are like people who build a castle and go down in shacks to live. He said, the system forbids me to sneeze. I hereby give myself permission to cough. And he's always talking about stuff like that. He begins by saying his major category was the existing individual, not as a concept. He was not concerned about the individual as a concept. He was concerned about him, his own existence. He was concerned not about death as a subject to be investigated. He was concerned about his death and its inevitable reality to him. And he made much out of the existing individual. A person is first exists, he would say, and then he determines what he will be. And that's the exact reverse of traditional philosophy. He first exists, and then he determines what he will be by his own choice as he moves from potentiality to actuality through a free, spontaneous, interactive choosing. Choice, the choice of a person is basic to the content of his personality. He is therefore very much concerned about the emotions. And when he talks about the individual, he's concerned about his emotions. And not just about any emotion. He's concerned not about things like joy and delight and happiness. He's concerned about anxiety, and he's concerned about dread, and he's concerned about fear, and he's concerned about melancholy, that kind of emotion. Kierkegaard believed that it's only as a person is faced with the very annihilation of his being that then he can choose to be or not to be. He believed that truth is subjective. Once Kierkegaard said something like this. He said, truth is subjective, it's subjectivity. And then he turned the concept around and said, subjectivity is truth. That's about as subjective as you can be. And he goes on to say that a thing is true if it's something for which you're willing to live and die, if you're passionately committed to it with the passion of the infinite. That's what makes a thing true. He is very famous for this quotation, and that's not an exact quotation. But it comes out of a postscript. He tells this story, and he uses this illustration. He says, here is an Orthodox Christian that goes up to the church to pray. He goes up and prays in a false spirit. Now, I imagine he's talking about the kind of person that goes to church and says, Our Father which art in heaven, and goes through the motions without ever knowing what he's talking about. The kind of person that sings hymns without ever knowing what the words are. And when you sing here, I raise my Ebenezer, and you don't even know what an Ebenezer is, you see. I mean, he's talking about just mouthing words and not really being involved in the worship service, just a false spirit. Here's a person, he says, who goes up to his church and prays in a false spirit. The true God, but in a false spirit, he prays. Here is another person, a heathen, who goes up to his temple and prays before his heathen idol, but with the passion of the infinite. Then Kierkegaard says, which one has the most truth? And he answers, the person who went to the Orthodox church, who had Orthodox beliefs, and who prayed falsely, is in reality praying to an idol. He's an idol worshiper. The person who went down to the shrine, the idol worshiper, and prayed with the passion of the infinite, is in fact worshiping the true God. Now, for me, looking at that situation, both of them would be wrong. But you see, for him, the thing that really made a difference was not the content of truth, but the way it was done, the how, the passionate commitment. Because there is so much of a lack of that in time, you can see why people would respond to this, because there's a real problem in society to which that kind of comment is being addressed. But it's an overreaction to the problem that exists. He is very much concerned with indirect communication. He makes use of a form of intuition. If I were standing here looking at that light over there, let's say that number 9 over there on the wall, that little card. Now that is perceptual information. I see the card. Everybody in this room presumably can see that card. And that's public knowledge that all of us have access to. But there's a knowledge that I have, even while I'm doing that, that's open only to me. And that is my knowledge of the fact that I have knowledge of that. My awareness of my awareness of that manner of event. Now, nobody has access to that but me. That's my private knowledge. My consciousness of my own consciousness. When I get outside of myself and I'm conscious of my own consciousness, nobody has access to that but me. And that's my private knowledge. And it's my knowledge for which I am accountable and for which I am responsible. And that's what that kind of inner penetration of the self is the thing he emphasized. And he did that too, because so many people, he felt, were the people who never faced up to themselves, never saw themselves as they really were never conscious of their own existence, he said. He also believed in paradox, and contemporary existentialists really make much of this, the idea of paradox. That is to say, that reality is really filled with contradictions. So that life really is irrational. Schaefer makes mention of this. He says that with the beginning of Kierkegaard, there was an abandonment of seeking unified field of knowledge. That is to say, make sense out of truth in a rational way. That is to say, making sense of the world in a rational way. Whatever the philosophy may have been up to that time, there was an attempt to make sense out of life in rational terms. You see, with the beginning of Kierkegaard, here man is trying to say there is no sense in life and simply to accept nonsense. And there's truth in that. I believe, however, that what the existentialist is doing is this. He is trying to say the only way you can make sense out of life is by saying it doesn't make sense. In other words, that makes sense to him. It makes sense to him to say that there is no sense, that things are in contradiction to each other, that life is irrational. And that's what leads to things like that you find in today's life. Existentialism is not primarily communicated by a philosophy course 302 that meets on Tuesday afternoons at 2 o'clock. That's not the way it's primarily communicated. It's primarily communicated through the media. It's primarily communicated through novels. And they're well read. They're some of the best novelists of our time, like Camus, for an example. He's writing from that point of view. Have you ever read a book like The Stranger, in which he is talking about how that person there simply makes sense of life by thinking that things don't make any sense? It's just a madness. It's that type of thing, thinking that produces things like a theater of the absurd. It's that kind of a thing. Some of our best playwrights today are coming from that point of view, like Tennessee Williams, for example. Some of the most creative people of our time are coming from that particular perspective, saying in a manner of speaking that the only way you can make sense out of life is to recognize that there are contradictions, and that life really is irrational, that you can't make sense out of it. And by doing that, you make sense out of it. He believed that a thing was good or bad in terms of whether or not it was an authentic or inauthentic choice. Let me try to describe to you what an authentic choice would be as over against an inauthentic choice. Let's say you're on the top of a burning building. It's about three stories high. The fire is coming ever closer to you. Now, if you jump off, you might kill yourself, you might not. Of course, you could jump in the fire. Now, what would you do? Now, I'm going to, elaborate and caricature this a little bit. Well, you might choose to jump in the fire, you might choose to jump overboard, you might choose just to sit there and do nothing, just sit there in a crazed condition. But that in itself would be a choice. It would be a choice not to choose. You might turn up if you had a portable radio, you might turn up a little louder, kind of take your mind off of it. If you had a portable refrigerator, you might get something else to eat, That's always a good thing to take your mind off your worries. Some of us have got that to prove, We've got some evidence of that. That would be, now, if you try to take your mind off of it, by the refrigerator or the radio or something like that, that would be an inauthentic choice. There may be somebody that would run out in the yard and say, "Hey, don't jump." And so you didn't jump because he said not jump. That would be an inauthentic choice, because it was something that was caused by the outside. Something coercive was affecting your choice. It might be a minister came out and read from your Bible and said, "Don't do it because God said thou shalt or thou shalt not." That would be a wrong. That would be an inauthentic choice. The authentic choice would be here in this crisis situation. And that's the kind of situation they're concerned about. You're in a crisis situation where you're threatened with the very annihilation of your being. Where there you can choose to be or not to be, there you choose, if you're aware of yourself, if you penetrate your own being and you're aware of yourself and you're aware of the realities and aware of the consequences, and now you choose, taking counsel from no one outside yourself, you choose willing to assume full responsibility for yourself and for your choice, You choose alertly and thoughtfully, making that choice, choosing yourself, as he says, in your eternal validity, then that's an authentic choice. And that's the kind of choice that he's concerned about you making. That's the good kind of choice that you make. To make a choice that requires no effort, like a person is hungry and he chooses to eat, that's not very much of a choice, you see, because it requires no, you're not faced with annihilation here, you see. It's just something that you, it requires not very much energy. You do the thing that comes naturally. And a person falls in love and gets married, that's just something you do because you just follow the least line of resistance. That's not, you're not threatened with the annihilation of your being, you see, when you do something. But when you're choosing where the choice really is a choice involving great risk, and you choose not taking counsel from anything outside of yourself, that for him is an authentic choice. Schaeffer uses the illustration of a man in his Escape from Reason, I believe. He uses the illustration of a person driving down the road, and he doesn't think about what he's doing. All he does think about what he's doing, he sees a person walking along the side of the road. And he thinks about what he's doing. He penetrates his own consciousness. He's aware of himself, aware of that person out there, aware of the risk. And he chooses authentically to pick up that person. So that would be a good choice. But the next day he's riding down the road and he's aware of himself and aware of that person, aware of the risk, and he takes full responsibility for himself. And this time, though he chooses, he decides to run over him. Now Schaeffer says both choices are equally valid and both choices are equally authentic. And that's right. And that's a valid observation of this point of view, because there's nothing outside yourself, you see, to tell you whether or not it's a good choice or not. You choose authentically, taking counsel from no one but yourself. That's an existential choice. Reading in Vandenberg, a contemporary existentialist educator, he talks about here, he uses this kind of an illustration. Here's a student out here in the classroom that's caught cheating. What would a teacher, from this perspective, do about that? Here you're caught cheating back here. What should the teacher do? If the teacher scolds you, he might force you to make an inauthentic choice. If he reprimands you, if he gives you a bad grade, he might force you to make an inauthentic choice, something from the outside. Now what the teacher must do, he says, Vandenberg says, is to see whether or not that choice was an authentic choice. It might have been an inauthentic choice, because he might have done that because of peer pressure, all the gang back there expecting to cheat just like they were doing. He might have done it because someone told him to. There could have been a number of reasons why he did that inauthentically, in which case he should try to have the student see what the choices were and then let him choose authentically. Now, if he looked at the situation, recognized the risks that were involved, and chose authentically, if he happened to choose still to cheat, then he simply has taken a course that's not generally acceptable to other people, but nevertheless an authentic choice. And that's all the teacher could do about it. The teacher should only be the occasion for facilitating an authentic choice, but no kind of external restraint could be applied. Well, let me say this. Wherever education is going on, whether it's on preschool level, or elementary or secondary or college, university, or graduate school, it is being undertaken from a religious perspective. It might be conscious, it might be unconscious. It might be existentialism or behaviorism or pragmatism or classical humanism or any one of a number of philosophies, or it might be some combination of those philosophies. Or it might be Christian. Imperfectly done, for no one perfectly does it. It could be from any one of a number of philosophical traditions. But please believe me, it's being done from some perspective, a religious perspective. And the thing that I'm concerned about is that it be done from a Christian perspective, and that you understand what this involves. What then does that mean you should do if you're attending a secular school? Does that mean that you ought to refuse to read anything that's not written by a Christian author? By no means. In the first place, by God's common grace, there are insights there that are helpful to you from the non-Christian writer that you have to appreciate. God gave the non-Christian a man too. And there are insights there that may be helpful. But what you do is to interpret what he has written and his insights in terms of your faith principles rather than his, instead of accepting his non-Christian perspective as being the factual thing that needs to be uncritically accepted. What should you do about a non-Christian professor? Should you publicly assault him? Should you, make yourself a continuous nuisance in the classroom, by challenging him every time he turns around? Well, I think a far better course would be for you in Christian love and compassion to cultivate him, and in a genuine, authentic relationship to share the reality of your faith in Christ with him. That's what I think you ought to do. And what does that mean, though, about your own subject matter major? If you have nothing but textbooks from a non-Christian point of view, if your professor is not necessarily Christian, what does that mean you ought to do? It means that you ought to try to look at the same phenomena of your field that textbook is looking at, that your professor is looking at, but to interpret it in the light of your own faith. And there's more and more material designed today to help you do that. And I'm sure that the leadership in this room are people who are well equipped to guide you in types of materials to read along this line. If you're majoring in psychology, you ought to begin to think through the major issues in your field in terms of your own perspective. If you're majoring in science, majoring in history, whatever it may be, you ought to begin to think through the problems in your field in terms of a Christian world and life view. What I'm in effect challenging you to do is something like this: to begin to develop in your life, and it's a lifelong process, to develop a Christian world and life view so that you live the whole of your life under the Lordship of Jesus Christ. We ought, you see, to love the Lord our God, not only with all of our souls, not only with all of our hearts, not only with all of our strength, but we ought to love the Lord our God with all of our minds. That's your obligation, and it is mine. Amen.